Chapter 19. You wouldn't want to be there. From my work in China manufacturing, I was already familiar with how old equipment made its way to the developing world. In one printing factory in South China, I saw an old Heidelberg press that had come in secondhand from Germany. At another factory, one that made pantyhose, I remembered some dingy-looking textile machinery that had been imported from Italy. The equipment at both of these plants looked outmoded, and I thought, China is where old machines come to die. And so, when Maria asked me in the spring to take her to a carnival that had come to town, I had to object. I had driven past and seen it myself. The carnival had the sort of rides that tossed passengers around and upside down. There was English lettering on some of them. These were rides that looked like they had previously worked in a state fair. I tried to imagine how they had come all the way to China, and I wondered about their mechanical worthiness. No, I told Maria, the carnival was not for me. She protested, and so I explained my fears. Well, maybe these rides were made in China, she offered. That's supposed to be a comfort? She pouted and was unrelenting. I next told her about a time I had been to another park up north in the city of Dalian. I had been traveling with a friend, and we discovered an amusement park, the permanent kind, and made our way to a big Ferris wheel there. It was late in the season, with almost no one else in the park. We were the only passengers on the tall ride. When we had been lifted to the top, the operator cut the motor for the wheel, and the car we were in rocked back and forth. The park was quiet, except for a great squeaking noise coming from the cars. They had not been properly oiled in ages, if ever. Trapped in the stopped car, I had the chance to look at the metal all around us. So much of the metalwork in China was done on the spot in a jerry-rigged fashion, and I could see that this had been an especially poor welding job. When the operator started the wheel and stopped it again suddenly, the entire ride shook, and for a moment I was certain that something would come loose and that my friend and I would fall out. What should have been one of the most gentle rides ended up being a spine-chilling experience, especially because it was made in China. It has been said that the price one pays for pursuing a profession is the intimate knowledge of its ugly side. Perhaps that is all that it was. In my case, my work in China manufacturing gave me another perspective, causing me to see many things differently. One day, Maria mentioned that something seemed to be wrong in the spare bedroom of my high-rise apartment. There was a smell, she said, and she suspected the furniture. Chinese furniture makers were in the habit of using formaldehyde, a regulated substance, in their manufacturing processes. Maria wanted to know if I had ever had the room tested with the formaldehyde kit to see if the furniture was emitting related fumes. A formaldehyde kit? Where in the world would I get a formaldehyde kit? I asked. It sounded scientific, like something found in a laboratory. Maria mentioned that the kits were sold everywhere and that I might get one at a supermarket or hardware store. It was true. The kits were not at all hard to find, and many families in China tested their own furniture. I wondered whether other economies in the world made formaldehyde kits so widely available. Manufacturing literacy was high in China, and locals knew how products were made. Formaldehyde in furniture was a common concern, just as tainted baby formula powder had been. Chinese consumers had a natural mistrust of local industrialists that was not exactly misplaced. With all of the problems we were facing at the soap and shampoo factory, I found myself losing faith in all sorts of products manufactured in China. I was soon careful to purchase health and beauty care products that were not made by local companies, but by large multinational corporations. But then I realized that the body wash I had been using, while it had been made by a reputable global company, was actually manufactured in a plant located in South China. Even if headquarters were in the United States, this company's manufacturing assets were in China. The staff was all local, and I knew these production managers well. They subscribed to the same philosophies that Sister at King Chemical had. They believed that what a consumer didn't know couldn't harm him. I found myself using less body wash, eventually relying on only hot water for my showers. When no one seemed to notice the difference, I stopped using the wash altogether, and then I stopped using soap as well. This was not a conscious decision, but in the back of my mind, I had begun to think, why take any chances? Working in manufacturing had caused me to lose faith. When clients came to China, we spent long days and nights together. At one point, I began asking importers if they had doubts of their own. Even before product recalls made global headlines, importers that I worked with admitted that they saw uncertainty with China-made goods. They did what they could, but shrugged off any real sense of worry. They had to earn a living after all, and, as one importer reminded me, every business comes with risk. Back in the United States, a debate was stirring. Economists who supported free trade without qualification were making the case that bilateral trade with China was helping Americans to save money. The often quoted statistic held that each U.S. family was saving $300 per year through outsourcing to China. Even if these savings were real, they seemed small and did not take into account certain risk factors, which were unquantifiable. How much was it worth to know that the products you purchased were lead or melamine free? When the quality crisis hit in earnest, some argued that shoddy products were nothing new. America had gone through the very same thing in the 19th century. It was what every developing economy must endure, and the problems would be sorted out in time. When politicians pushed for free trade with China, though, none of them had ever suggested that the American public would be involved in any sort of trade-off. If anyone had joked about how sending manufacturing orders to China came with a jump back to 1849, a time that predated consumer safety protection, for only modest savings, most consumers would have been against it. After the crisis in toys hit in 2007, I received a note from executives at Toys R Us who had read an article I wrote on quality fade that year. They wanted to talk generally about the challenges facing China manufacturing, and one senior executive wanted assurances that what China was going through was no different than what Japan had faced in the 1950s when it had a reputation for manufacturing low-quality goods. China's case in the 2000s differed from Japan in the 1950s or the United States in the 19th century. One of the reasons was the type and extent of quality manipulation that was common in China. There was a degree of quality cheapening that was the result of mere corner cutting, which involved skimping on raw materials or taking shortcuts in the production process. But you also had serious game playing that went on between a manufacturer and an importer, instances where manufacturers were manipulating quality levels in such a way that their customers could not tell at all what had been done to the product. The phrase corner cutting was too benign when the manipulation of quality involved changing the product so that the manufacturer could succeed in bypassing quality assurance tests set up by third-party laboratories. Never have so many manufacturers in an economy tried to slip one past the inspectors, and never has an economy had so many foreign agents on the ground in order to preempt disaster. My role in China was to facilitate trade between China and the United States. I was a go-between. But after working for many years in the manufacturing sector, I had doubts. Manufacturers were simply much better at playing cat-and-mouse games. China watchers were suggesting that quality would improve in time, and that as the country developed, there would be fewer problems. My own experiences suggested the opposite, that things were getting worse, if only because factory owners were picking up more tricks as they went along. And importers who placed increasingly large orders in China did not help matters, but gave factory owners courage and the sense that they could push limits. I increasingly expressed my views to importers that I worked with. It was all but impossible to prevent quality manipulation schemes, I would point out. The factory could not be beaten. I had become cynical. While working in China manufacturing, I sometimes suggested to clients that they not bring some products to China. I was aware that by making such suggestions, I was turning into a hypocrite, like the butcher who whispered to his customers that they ought to consider the value of a vegetarian diet. While continuing to work in the industry, I began to make notes, and I tried to justify my staying in the quality game by thinking that maybe American consumers were better off having someone like me on the job, someone who actually cared. Seriously, though, who was I kidding? Manufacturers I worked with got away with whatever they wanted, and importers did not have the leverage to pressure their suppliers to behave in an ethical fashion. Some said that the answer to China's quality challenge was to test more of its products. The problem with this solution, at least in health and beauty care, was that it was too expensive. For many product categories, Johnson Carter earned not even 10 cents per bottle. If there were 20,000 pieces in a 40-foot container, the importer might earn only $2,000 in profit, and then the laboratory wanted to charge more than $200 for each separate test that it might run. Testing just one bottle for the presence of five different toxic substances could run more than $1,000. Johnson Carter's solution was to put the ball in its customers' court. If the retailer wanted to test for the presence of certain forbidden chemicals, it was welcome to do so. We would send the bottles off to the laboratory to have the tests run, and then the retailer would be billed at a later point. These retailers did the math and realized that they couldn't test very much of the product and still earn a profit. Anyway, what were they going to test? The laboratory had to be told what it was testing, and that was the problem. If the factory did introduce an inappropriate substance, we would need to know what that substance was in order to run the screen. In the end, retailers decided to take importers at their word, and importers had no choice but to do the same with manufacturers, take their word that they were creating a product that was effective and not harmful. It might have worked, except unilateral changes made by manufacturers to products, without warning, suggested risks that were incalculable. Checking the product one morning, I noticed that our cherry-scented liquid soap smelled strange. It was the first time that I had noticed it. The product smelled like cherry all right, but it was a medicinal kind. Someone had switched the fragrances, and the cherry scent we had now was closer to the kind you might find in a throat lozenge. Sister insisted that they were using the same fragrance, but a week later, I got confirmation from the New York office that the cherry scent did not match samples that had been sent to them from the manufacturer. Bernie worried that quality fragrances had been swapped out for inferior ones, or for ones that we did not care for anyway. There was a cultural issue involving fragrances. What smelled nice to Chinese consumers did not necessarily smell the same to those in the United States. I suggested that we take the entire product line to an international supplier of fragrances. Having a reputable foreign supplier deliver fragrances instead of a local supplier that we could not control was really the only way to assure that the factory would not take small savings and ruin the product. We knew of just such a fragrance supplier in Hong Kong, and so I made plans to visit them. There were few things more refreshing than an excursion to Hong Kong. Guangzhou was an old Chinese city, and it had a crumbled look to it. The tones were all muted grays. Hong Kong was a world-class city, one that, at least in the commercial parts of town, was always crisp-looking by comparison. But the people of Hong Kong did not necessarily believe themselves lucky, and they often complained about pollution. As for us in Guangzhou, we got so little direct sunlight that their complaints across the border seemed laughable. At least in Hong Kong, you could see your own shadow walking down the street. The factories in mainland China produced so much particulate matter that the skies were dark. If the sun appeared at all, it shone weak and enfeebled, like a tiger in a Chinese zoo, defanged and declawed. Guangzhou was not entirely backwards. There were signs that the place was coming along. A surprising number of luxury brands could be found in the city, as well as other examples of extravagance towards the top end of the purchasing range. There were German car dealerships like Mercedes-Benz and BMW, and there were surprisingly large displays for brands such as Bentley, Rolls-Royce, and Ferrari. This did not mean that you could get whatever you needed in town, though. There was no good English bookstore, and you were hard-pressed to find a shop that made a decent loaf of bread. This was one of the things on my mind as the train pulled into Hong Kong, a simple sandwich, one with slices of avocado. Though there were plenty of fruits and vegetables available in Guangzhou, avocados were nowhere to be found. The lack of availability of certain fruits in South China presented a real challenge at King Chemical. Perhaps even more surprising, shoes were also in short supply in the region. The majority of shoes that the United States imported were coming from China, and yet there was hardly any selection in South China, and the factories and trading companies were just a stone's throw from where I lived. On the train, pulling in across the border, cell phones began to jingle. It was the sound of Hong Kong phone companies picking up the cross-border roaming signal. The ringing sound was like a welcome to the former British colony. Rushing off the train along with others who were equally excited to have arrived, I went to pick up a pair of black leather China-made shoes and grabbed my lunch, a chicken sandwich with avocado, and I thought, first-time visitors to East Asia who visited both Guangzhou and this global capital might easily confuse where the boom was actually taking place. I had just enough time to meet an old friend in the financial district before heading off to the fragrance supplier. On a crowded pedestrian platform in Central, the main business district, I spotted my friend, who worked in finance, analyzing and assessing companies in mainland China. "How is Guangzhou?" he asked me. "You mean how is China?" I said. It was an old joke between us. For him, I was the friend who lived just over the border in that rough-and-tumble world. For me, he was that friend who lived a more relaxed life in surroundings that were comfortable. In response to the slight ribbing, my friend was quick to let me know that he had plans to move to China. "My company might post me to Beijing, actually," he said. The year before, it had been that his company might move him to Shanghai, but but the relocation never transpired, and he continued to report on China from Hong Kong. "Why not Guangzhou?" I asked, just to see the quick flash of horror in his face. Beijing and Shanghai were two options. Anything else for a financial professional was out of the question. At the mention of Guangzhou, he straightened his tie and ran a hand through his curly hair. "I'll move to China," he said, "when the timing is right." And that was the issue, really, the timing of it all. China was still seen as underdeveloped. Healthcare and education were inadequate, and then there was all that business about wanting to find English books, a decent pair of shoes, and avocados. The pollution was also a common complaint, but it was only going to be getting worse in the years to come, which suggested that it was not only a matter of waiting another couple of years. Jim Rogers, the global investor, had recently made headlines when he sold his Manhattan townhome for $15 million and announced that he was moving his family to China. He said that he wanted to leave the United States because the focus of the global economy was shifting to mainland China. Rogers was a vocal booster for China's real estate sector, and it appeared for a moment that he was personally going to take advantage. Flying around China, Rogers considered a number of different cities to live in, including Shanghai, Dalian, and Qingdao. But in the end, the China Bull settled with his family in Singapore. It was a nice, safe place, an efficiently run city, but much like Hong Kong, it was not exactly China. Financial analysts who reported on the mainland Chinese economy from the hermetically sealed environments of Hong Kong and Singapore were upbeat on China. Sure they were. They didn't have to suffer the constant reminders of how difficult the place was. Finance professionals who talked up China didn't mind the opacity of the place. They minded having to report on the enigmatic economy while living inside it. They didn't mind the occasional trip into mainland China, but they were sure to make their visits brief. Somehow amid the economic boom, it did not strike anyone as particularly odd or comic. China was apparently the place to be, it was just that you didn't actually want to be there. I took my suitcase of soap and shampoo samples and wheeled it down the hall toward the offices of the fragrance supplier. Just outside the door, I spotted the Frenchman, Yves, with whom I had an appointment. The look on my face must have given away my first impression of him. "You were surprised that I smoke," he said, and then went into an unsolicited explanation of why so many perfumers smoked. "After working with the fragrances for too long, the nose needs a break," he said. Inside his office, he brought me to a showcase that housed many products using the company's fragrances. There were some global brands there that I recognized. He took me on a small tour of their offices, which included a walk through the warehouse. As soon as we entered, Eve excused himself and went looking among the steel drums for something. A round-faced Hong Kong man stood at a table, mixing chemicals, sniffling as though he had a cold. I asked if he was feeling well. "I'm always like this," he said. "From the fragrances?" I asked. He looked surprised, as though I might have hit on something. "You know," he said, "come to think of it, I once took a 2-week holiday and my sinuses cleared up." I asked if he ever thought of quitting, but he said that he needed the job. In all the time I had been working in mainland China, I thought, I had never run into a factory worker who complained. The showroom at the fragrance company doubled as an office. Eve brought me back to the showroom and asked that I open my case and place my samples on the table. I was to hand him the bottles without showing him the labels. He did not want any visual cue. I took out the cherry-scented liquid soap and handed him the bottle. He held it up to his nose and paused. "Cherry," he said. He noted the medicinal quality and said that his company could provide a better fragrance. "Hand me another, something not so easy this time." Instead of a fruit-scented variety, I reached for one called Herbal Fresh. Eve brought it to his face while closing his eyes, and this time lifted his nose slightly in the direction of the ceiling. He took in a deep breath. Our formulations were meant for discount stores, and yet he handled the product like it was vintage wine. "Almond," he pronounced, and placed the bottle on the table. I took up the sample and had a sniff for myself. "You're right," I said. "Of course I am," he said, with a wry smile. The next sample I handed him was labeled Aloe Vera. He spent less time on this one. "It's also almond," he said. "Also almond? Are you sure?" He looked at me and cocked an eyebrow. I handed him more samples, and he gave the same response, almond, to a number of other styles. For an as-yet-unknown reason, almost half of our samples were made up of this mysterious almond scent. Someone at the factory must have made a substitution, I realized. "We have a problem here," I told Sister on the phone. Hong Kong was supposed to be a part of China, but the phone call was an international one. The connection was terrible, and Sister could not hear me. "What?" she said. "The fragrances, they are all almond. I can't hear you. Why did you switch the fragrances? What?" I gave up on complete sentences and shouted the word for almond into the phone. "Shinren." The one word made it through, and Sister at once launched into a denial. "Meiyo, meiyo." When I got back to the factory the next day, she was no longer in the denying mood. She admitted the fragrance switch and said that she thought the almond scent was nicer. "Didn't you think so?" she asked. My opinion was beside the point, I told her, just as her own didn't matter. Johnson Carter's customer placed its order and had already received a sample set. It approved the order based on what we sent them, and the customer had an expectation of what it was going to receive. With all that we had been through with King Chemical, Sister still didn't get it. The nature of the customer relationship itself was something that eluded her. She made unilateral changes on the product instead of having a discussion first. The way she figured things, it was easier to beg for forgiveness after the fact than to ask for permission in advance. We had millions of bottles on their way to the United States. Those who were in charge of buying at the retailers didn't like surprises, and if they discovered that we made changes without their prior approval, we were finished. For whatever reason, Sister could not or would not understand that. For every single major quality fiasco, the sort that would make the papers, there were probably hundreds of smaller disasters that never got any publicity at all. Some importers collapsing cardboard boxes, the flimsiest of plastic bottles, or the generic scent of almond that was placed in random bottles. These instances of quality manipulation were never going to make the news, though perhaps they also should have. The lives of consumers would not be affected, but they would have been telling examples of the challenges that importers faced. Perhaps knowing about these instances would have made the more serious cases of quality failure less of a surprise. Part of the problem in understanding the quality situation in China was in the way the media reported on it. They dealt with instances as isolated cases, or at worst, as problems facing a specific industry. When toys were found to have lead paint in them, it was suddenly a toy industry problem. When melamine turned up in dairy products, it was described as a dairy industry problem. These issues were more universal than that. They were China problems. Anyone who worked in Chinese manufacturing for a number of years and over a broad number of product categories could have predicted the quality crisis. Chinese factories, across a broad number of sectors, were in the habit of ignoring the requests of their foreign customers and thought nothing of changing specifications without notice. It was easy to see where a habit like this would lead. A common phrase heard around manufacturing companies was, "Anquan di, safety first." One supplier joked with me that these companies were taking as their motto instead, "Zuanquan di, make money first." Some blamed the Communist Party for this attitude. The one-party government does what it wants, when it wants. And while there are advantages to ruling without restraint or controversy, such a system limits predictability, and it has left Chinese entrepreneurs keenly aware that they are subject to the whims of officials who may or may not know which policy is best. Knowing that entrepreneurs may be focused on the short term, industry observers have suggested that the manufacturing sector's moral gap might be solved through increasing third-party inspections. But there were too many problems with such a fix. The first was that importers had to know what they were looking for in the first place. Unscrupulous industrialists were not going to tell importers where to look. Some suggested that the answer to quality problems was to pay the factories more for their merchandise. One problem with that solution was that price competition was severe. Paying higher prices would push Johnson Carter out of business. The other issue was the assumption that money could solve the problem. Suppliers that acted unscrupulously at 30 cents per unit were not likely going to behave differently at 36 cents a unit. The factory owner that believed herself clever enough to substitute ingredients without asking permission could not be counted on to do the right thing just because the price of the product had been increased by a few pennies. Chinese manufacturing had serious issues, and these were not very well understood while looking at them from a great distance.